This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina is full of bluegrass legends, and near the top of the list is Curly Seckler. Curly grew up on picking cotton on his family's farm in the tiny town of China Grove, North Carolina. He listened to folks like Charlie Monroe on the radio and eventually landed a gig playing alongside Charlie in the late 1930s. Curly's signature style on the mandolin and his tenor singing soon caught the attention of Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. For more than a decade, Curly played with the Foggy Mountain Boys and helped lay the foundation for commercial bluegrass.
I am reading today in my book of the past from his pages so yellow. As I read the book through, are worth more than silver or gold.
There's a clip of Curly Seckler and Lester Flatt singing That Old Book of Mine. That's 1953, and one of the songs Curly performed during his musical career that spanned more than 50 years. Curly's legacy landed him a spot at the International Bluegrass Music Association's Hall of Fame in 2004. My guest today is Penny Parsons. She's Curly's biographer and former manager. Her new book is called Foggy Mountain Troubadour, The Life and Music of Curly Seckler. It looks at Curly's journey through the cotton fields of North Carolina to bluegrass's main stage. Welcome to the program, Penny. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you.
How do you describe Curly Seckler when people want to know about him? What do you tell us? First thing you tell people?
Well, he's certainly a pioneer of this music, and he's really one of the few that are left now that have seen and participated in the entire history of bluegrass music.
And that tenor vocal style, I mean, that, you know, for people who may have heard bluegrass and not be familiar with it, I mean, that's central to what we call that high, lonesome sound, and that was the signature in a lot of ways, right?
Yes, for sure. And his singing with Lester Flatt was something that just seemed to belong. You know, they seemed to belong together. And even now, people think of those classic recordings that they made in the early 50s as the gold standard for bluegrass singing.
Well, tell us where he came from, a little bit about growing up in China Grove. What'd that look like for him?
Well, China Grove is a small town. It's just south of Salisbury. So Salisbury was the big town to go to. But he grew up on a 150-acre farm and with seven brothers and sisters. And his dad died when Curly was 9 years old. So his mom was running that farm with all these kids by herself, basically.
And they were sustaining themselves on that farm, right? Growing a little bit of cotton.
That's right. Yeah. They grew cotton and corn and wheat, and they had some animals, and they had a kitchen garden, they called it. So they could trade for what they didn't have. They could trade eggs for sugar and flour and salt that, you know, they couldn't grow. And so they didn't need money.
Yeah. So were they sort of among that group of people who just never knew they were poor until somebody told them?
Yeah. And they never knew there was a depression.
Wow. But that said, so it sounds kind of romantic and lovely if you don't have to do all that cotton picking. But it wasn't for Curly, right?
No, it was challenging. And he had bronchial asthma growing up. So that was a big challenge for him. He would go up to bed and they were sleeping on straw mattresses, and he would start to wheeze, and he'd have to come downstairs and sleep in a rocking chair because he just couldn't take it.
Well, Curly is still with us. He's 96 years old now, right?
That's right.
And we had the opportunity to talk with him a few years ago, and he talked with us about the working on that farm.
Picking that cotton, that's a hard job. You got down on your knees, you were out the toes of your shoes and your knees. Then if you stooped over, you were out that little wheat back we had.
You told your mother you were going to be a musician rather than...
I come up on the road in 1939. I told her, I said, you want to see me pick my last pod of cotton? She said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, just watch me at the end of this row. I ain't going to pick no more cotton after that. So we got to the end of that row, and I says, Mom, look here. Sec is picking up his last pod of cotton. And she said, what on earth are you going to do? I said, I'm going into the music business. She said, good Lord, young'un, you'll starve to death. And I thought the first 5 years of it, she was right. It was rough.
That's bluegrass musician Curly Seckler. We talked with him in 2008. My guest is Penny Parsons. Her new book is a biography on Curly called Foggy Mountain Troubadour. He did leave. He played music with his brothers, right, for a little bit.
That's right. They started a band called the Yodeling Rangers in 1935, and none of them knew how to yodel. But
well, they could range pretty well.
Yeah, they had watched the cowboy singers in the movies, and so that's where they got the idea. And they wore these great big hats and played around at schoolhouses in the area.
So he was serious about it even from a young age. Listened to Charlie Monroe a lot on the radio too, right?
Well, the Monroe brothers it was at that time. So they were still together, Bill and Charlie. Yeah.
So what about that? When did he make the transition? When he finally set off and he talked about those first 5 years, what was going on those first 5 years for him?
Yeah, well, WSTP radio went on the air in 1939 in Salisbury. And so the Yodeling Rangers landed a program, and it eventually was on four different stations around the state. And that's when Charlie Monroe heard Curly. Charlie was in Raleigh at WPTF. And so he heard Curly singing and recruited him to join his new band, the Kentucky Partners. And they went to Wheeling, West Virginia on the Wheeling Jamboree and WWVA.
Well, and, you know, I guess we should talk about, the importance of radio, especially here, but particularly in the mountains, Piedmont, but where you basically, that was the only information you had because the next valley over, the transmitter wouldn't go that far. So each station had its own character and its own set of
musicians. That's right. And, radio was live back then, most of it. So the bands that were playing were doing live shows. They'd have a 15-minute radio program.
So Charlie Monroe picks him up. They go to Wheeling. What was that like? What was that partnership like for them?
Well, it was good. Curly learned a lot from Charlie. One of the first things he says he learned was how to dress. Charlie said, "The way you dress is 50% of your show." And Curly showed up the first day for work with like a sports shirt and slacks on. And Curly said, "Don't you ever let me catch you again without a white shirt and a tie."
Wow. But he dropped the cowboy hat, or did he? Kept the
cowboy
hat.
No, they had the cowboy hats then.
Kept the cowboy hats going.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. So they were in Wheeling. Now, were they touring? What was going on at the time?
Yeah, they were touring. But see, at that time, bands could only go so far in their touring because they had to be back to do their early morning live radio program the next morning. So they could only go maybe about 200 miles out.
So that picture we all had of the bands going from radio station to radio station when we were kids, that was literally true here.
It was literally true. They would play out an area. Wow. They'd play for a while, and then they'd have to move on to a different radio station.
Well, they eventually caught the ear of Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. Tell us about that, how they came together.
They first met in 1948. They were both, Curly was with Charlie Monroe, based at WCYB in Bristol, and so were Flatt and Scruggs. And so he met them then, and they kind of, kept track of where he went. And Mack Wiseman was with them at the time. He left around Christmas time. And so they needed a new tenor singer, and Lester called Curly. He was in Augusta, Georgia at that time with Jim and Jesse working down there, and he took the bus to Bristol and met him and joined Flatt and Scruggs.
What was the blend in terms of income stream? What was the pay from the radio station versus touring and then recording? What part did that play in these early years?
Most of the bands did not get paid for playing on the radio.
So that was promotion, right?
Yeah, used the radio shows to promote their show dates, which is how they made their living. And now some of them would sell things on the radio. They could sell baby chickens or, it was all kinds of stuff. Yeah. They'd sell songbooks,
Martha White's Flower, but then not somebody else's product. But you're saying they could sell their own stuff.
They could. Well, I guess they made a deal with some company, that they would sell their stuff. Yeah, endorsement deal. But when Curly first went to work with Charlie Monroe in 1939, he was making $20 a week, and that was really good pay.
Wow. So Flatt and Scruggs, they teamed up. They needed a tenor. They thought this guy sounded pretty good, although apparently they thought he's kind of a smart aleck. Huh?
You read that part of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, he went down and met him. He had this Packard limousine that he and his brother had bought to tour, and they hadn't done very well. And so they were driving it, but they didn't. Curly said, "We didn't have a cracker in it." and they went to meet Flatt and Scruggs at a show date, and I guess Curly was trying to impress him. But later on, Earl said, "Lester said to me he thought you were the biggest smart aleck in the world."
Well, they kept him because he was also one of the finest tenors in the bluegrass industry at the time. Let's hear a clip. This is a song called "No Mother or Dad." Curly actually wrote this song shortly after joining Flatt and Scruggs. Let's listen to a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about it.
Now,
brother and I are all alone. We have no place to call our home. It will never be like home no more till we meet them on that other shore. Oh, Mother, dear, and Daddy, too, we wish that we were there with you. It's not the same since you were away.
Clip from the 1949 song No Mother or Dad, written and performed by Curly Seckler with Lester Flatt. My guest is Curly's biographer and former manager, Penny Parsons. Tell us more about that song.
Curly wrote that in the fall of 1949. They were, Flatt and Scruggs were based in Knoxville at WROL. They had a morning radio program, and Curly went back to his hotel room after the program and got to missing the folks back home in China Grove. That's when he wrote that song. And just a few months later, December 1949, they recorded it.
Well, what about his songwriting career? Was there was that a big part of his legacy today and what we remember him for?
It's not as big a part of his legacy as maybe Lester Flatt's, but he did write some really good songs, and we've heard some of those today.
His tenor singing, also, you alluded to it or made reference to it a little bit earlier, the fact that it was seemed to be the perfect match. And how did it work so well together?
It's hard to really explain it, but they just fit together really well. Curly is really good at matching whoever he sings with. It's not just Lester Flatt, but you listen to him on other recordings, and he matches whoever he's singing with, you know, with the harmony. And he says that he was able to tell whether Lester was going to take a short breath or a long breath.
Wow.
It got to that point.
He's also known for his mandolin rhythm chop. Tell us about mandolin playing and the significance of that in his career.
Yeah, he originally had a tenor banjo, but he got rid of that once he got together with Tommy Scott in 1941. And so then he played the mandolin for most of the rest of his career. And he wasn't a flashy mandolin player. He wasn't a great mandolin player. Lester Flatt used to say, well, you're not the greatest mandolin player in the world, but I like the way you held it.
So he dressed right and he held his mandolin.
Right.
In fact, I think we haven't had Curly talking about just that the last time he was on the show.
Lester used to say, Sig said, you ain't the greatest mandolin picker in the world, and you know that, and I know it. But he said, I always liked the way you held it.
In his own words, Curly Seckler. I'm talking to his biographer, Penny Parsons. Her new book on Curly is called Foggy Mountain Troubadour. At the height of their popularity, the Foggy Mountain Boys, of course, traveling up and down the East Coast, they were really working hard, right? How do they maintain that schedule?
Oh, it was amazing. They were working 6 and 7 days a week in the mid-50s, mid and late 50s. And see, in 1955, they started a TV program. And so they were doing live TV because TV was in its infancy at that point. So it was just like the radio originally was. They had to do live TV. And at one point, they were doing a 2,500-mile route every week to do live TV.
Wow. And then did they have, I would assume they had a date then every night. So
they would play the TV show, and then they would play a drive-in theater.
Wow. Well, here's Curly one more time talking about life on the road with the Foggy Mountain Boys.
I'm telling you the truth. We worked 7 days a week. You didn't never know when you was going to get a chance to stop somewhere and get a good meal. You know, I'll never forget one time. We was running pretty short on time, and we stopped at these little markets along the road, you know, and pick up some little pies, you know. Back then you could buy them little old pies for about 15 or 20 cents, and I guess they're $3 today. Pie's gone up. but anyway, we run in there and get some of them after we'd worked the show somewhere. And, of course, we'd got on that bus, you know, and didn't have too good lights on it. Everybody got to eating them pies, you know, and Lester got to eating his. And directly he said, Sick. He called me Sick and a few other names. But he said, this is the toughest crust that I've ever tasted on a pie in my life. I said, well, Lester, let's see here. Let me see what's going on here. I said, Lester, you're supposed to move the cardboard off the bottom of it before you eat it. But he was a dandy. Lester Flatt was one of the greatest.
Curly Seckler on our program in 2008. He is still going strong at the age of 96. Penny Parsons is his biographer, and she is here with me today talking about her biography of Curly Seckler called Foggy Mountain Troubadour. Well, pie's gone up, and a lot of things were changing in the 1960s. How did things change for Curly in the 60s?
Well, Curly left the Foggy Mountain Boys in 1962 and started driving a truck. And actually, he made a lot more money doing that than he had as a sideman. But he still kept his hand in music. And he would arrange his truck deliveries where he was near a bluegrass festival, and he could go perform at the festival. And then eventually, in 1973, Lester Flatt talked him into joining his band, the Nashville Grass. Flatt and Scruggs had split up in 1969. So he joined the Nashville Grass and stayed until Lester passed away in 1979, and then Curly took over the band at Lester's request. So.
Well, you can obviously hear his personality. He's a great performer. He's a great showman, so we're all happy he didn't stay in those cotton fields. What was his stage presence? If you're with Flatt and Scruggs, do you get much of a chance to show that personality on stage, or was he in the background?
Well, one of the things he found out immediately when he joined the band was that Lester at one point would just walk off the stage and turn it over to him to be the MC. So that was a baptism by fire for him, but he got right with it, and you know, he had learned a lot of that from Charlie Monroe, how to do that. And so he was a great MC, and what they would do is Lester would walk off, Curly would sing some of his own songs, and Earl might do a banjo instrumental. They'd do, you know, some instrumentals and that kind of thing. Then Lester would come back, and they'd do some gospel and finish the program. So Curly knew how to do that. He was very charming and funny.
Yeah.
And has great stories to tell.
Well, we've got another sample of his music. Here he is singing Sitting on Top of the World with Bill Monroe.
It's one of the few times you're going to hear anybody sing tenor with Bill Monroe, because Curly Seckler had sung and made so many great records singing tenor with Lester and Earl. He's going to sing tenor with Bill Monroe on this song. Bill will do lead, and D, fellas, Sitting on Top of the World. All right, Curly, get ready.
Was in the spring one sunny day, my girl left me, she's gone away.
Now we're going to cut that short a little bit because they said, here it is, Sitting on Top of the World, we're going to do it in D, but they didn't do it in D, did they? Or was Bill trying to trip them up a little bit?
Bill usually did that song in C, but Bill liked to challenge people. And so to have another tenor singer singing tenor to him was a challenge for Bill. So he wanted to see if he could beat Curly at his own game. But Curly always said, I went across those treetops like a jet.
And as you say, really adapted. Wow, great. Curly, what's his legacy today? What do you think? What do you think he means to bluegrass musicians today?
Well, he's certainly one of the greatest tenor harmony singers ever in bluegrass music. I mean, for personally, when I think of the three tenors in bluegrass, I think of Bill Monroe, Ralph Stanley, and Curly Seckler. And I think a lot of people agree with me on that.
That's great stuff. Penny Parsons, her new book is called Foggy Mountain Troubadour, The Life and Music of Curly Seckler. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Frank. I really enjoyed it.
As always, you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. We've got more information and a link to any of Penny's visits around town, although I guess you've already been to Quail Ridge Books and other places. But
yes, I've been to Quail Ridge, and I've got several coming up in the next month or so. So check the website.
Check it out. Just ahead, we're going to talk about a new book that explores questions about memory, grief, and belonging. Stay with us on The State of Things.
Just a few short months ago, he was here with me, and then they called his number to go across the sea. I still can hear his happy voice and see his curly head. Oh, somehow I can't believe my baby boy is dead. They sent him to Corville, his heart was light and gay. Hard for me to realize they send him home this way.